Will your church be one of the Issues Etc. 300? Hi, this is Todd Wilkin. We're looking for 300 congregations to pledge $1,000 to Issues Etc. in their budgets. To find out more about the Issues Etc. 300, click the support page of our website, issuesetc.org. You'll even find a one-page informational flyer. Please consider including Issues Etc. in your church's mission or advertising budget. The Issues Etc. 300.
They say that breaking up is hard to do. Now I know that it's true. Don't say that.
We're concluding part three of our four-part series on the Great Schism of 1054. It was a time when the church, well, split into two, but was it a permanent split? Was it sayonara on both sides? Good riddance on both sides for good? Sometimes that's how it's depicted, and certainly the canyon, the gap between the two churches, East and West, has grown over the last 1,000 years. But what about the years that came almost immediately after the Great Schism of 1054? Joining us for part three of our four-part series, Dr. Matt Phillips. He's Associate Professor of History at Concordia University, Nebraska. Matt, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Good to be back.
You said when we concluded our conversation the last time that the Crusades, so famous and yet so poorly known by even the best students of history, had a big role to play in both bringing about the schism, but also later in attempts to heal the schism. Bring us up to speed.
So, as I said, the date 1054 is kind of came about as the papacy in the West was kind of trying to assert its authority more than it had before that time, and it was really the descendants, not literal descendants, but the official descendants of that papacy that called the Crusades. But they were really calling, part of the Crusades was to bring about unity again of the East and West churches. But what often ended up happening throughout the 12th century was the Latins, the people from the West, and the Greeks, as they called them, you know, that's kind of what they went by, ended up sometimes they would fight together, sometimes they would not fight together. And this came to a head in 1204 with the Fourth Crusade that kind of got off course by everybody's reckoning and ended up sacking Constantinople. Even the Pope who called the Crusade kept telling them, sent them letters and told them not to take Constantinople. Once they do, however, he absolves them and sees it as a blessing, and they appoint a Latin patriarch of Constantinople. So from 1204 to 1261, you actually had what was called the Latin Empire. So the Byzantine Empire was then reunited with the West, technically, and there was a Latin-speaking patriarch and Latin Western, many of them Italian or French, people who ruled the Byzantine Empire.
Well, let's take a break right there. When we come back, we'll pick up right there in history, that time where, I guess at least politically and ecclesiastically, there was unity, but it was more by force of conquest than by theological agreement. Dr. Matt Phillips is our guest, part three of our four-part series on the Great Schism of 1054. Issues Etc. relies on a small group of faithful supporters called the Issues Etc. Reformation Club. These people have pledged to become monthly or annual contributors to Issues Etc., and this allows us to budget our expenses more efficiently. Now, there are four levels of giving. The Confessor, $25 monthly, or an annual gift of $250. The Apologist, $50 monthly, or an annual gift of $500. The Reformer, $100 monthly, or an annual gift of $1,000. And the Patron, $200 monthly, or an annual gift of $2,000. Each Reformation Club member receives premiums like books, transcripts, and the I Have Issues t-shirt. You can join the Issues Etc. Reformation Club by contacting Craig. His email address, craig@issuesetc.org. Or you can call 618-223-8385, 618-223-8385. The Issues Etc. Reformation Club.
Smartest listeners in radio. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Russia's Reversal.
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
After decades of promoting abortion, the Russian government is finally on the verge of reversing course. Years of population decline have finally spurred Russian leaders to action. The Russian parliament recently passed a bill designed to decrease abortions in the country. The bill requires all advertisements for abortion services to dedicate at least 10% of the space in the ad to detailing the risks of abortion. By making women aware of the health risks associated with interrupting a pregnancy, Russian leaders hope to convince many of its pregnant women to give birth rather than abort.
This is Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List, inviting you to join us in our battle for life. For more, go online to sba-list.org.
Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. We're coming to you live this Friday afternoon, October the 21st, concluding. We're part three of our four-part series. Far from the conclusion, in fact. There's so much more history to recount. The Great Schism of 1054 may have happened in 1054, but it sounds like it was over with almost as soon as it got going. Dr. Phillips, it sounds like what you said before the break, that almost with that within decades of 1054, the East and West were united without the lifting of any mutual excommunications and without any real theological reconciliation.
Yeah, I mean, with the First Crusade, a lot of it has to do with political necessities too, sometimes. But with the First Crusade, it wasn't always clear, they don't express it clearly as to how deep the schism was. The schism is deepened in 1204, as I said, 100 and so years later, with the sacking of Constantinople and with the, as I said right at the end of the break, the Latin Patriarchate. Now, a lot of people say, oh, well, you got a Latin Patriarchate and the papacy, they're connected to the papacy. Well, for the most part, most of the Byzantine Christians, or the Greeks, as we'll call them, did not accept either the authority of the Latin emperors, which they did have some authority in part of the Eastern world until 1261, nor did most of them accept the Latin-speaking church. So you actually had three different groups in the what was still the Byzantine Empire that were never controlled by the Latin Empire that had their own church, Greek-speaking, and authority. So both politically in the East and religiously in the East, the schism continued in that sense.
At the time, did they talk about this as a split church? I mean, I'm talking about those years from 1204 when the Latin Patriarchate is there, when at least one might have looked in from the outside not knowing anything else and said, well, look, come on, they're all speaking the same language. They appear, except for a few groups, to be mostly united. Did they think of it in terms of a split church?
Yes. Although, you know, the Latin patriarchs could have put on a good face. The people who didn't, who were Greek and never accepted his authority openly, unless they were forced to, and there were separate churches. There was no real unification that we could really speak of. There were certainly people who went along with it because they had to, or for political sake, or the Westerners who moved to Constantinople and lived in the empire. But for the most part, it was never recognized formally.
What happened in 1261? You mentioned that date several times.
Well, basically, that's when the Latin Empire finally just kind of dissolved. There was not enough local support, for one, to keep it going, and they constantly needed new crusaders or supporters coming from the West. And you could get a crusade. You could fulfill your crusade vow now by going and just fighting for the Latin Empire against these Greek rebels in what today would be the Balkans and in the southern Black Sea area. So it's kind of a strange expansion of the notion of crusade, but popes basically began giving out crusade vows to go help the Latin Empire. So now you're not even fighting Muslims, which was the original, you know, the Muslims in the Middle East. And it just kind of falls apart politically in 1261, and you have, from a Byzantine perspective, the restoration of the Byzantine leader, Michael VI, I believe it is. No, Michael VIII, excuse me. Michael VIII is restored. He's the restored emperor in 1261.
Let's talk about a couple of the councils, the church councils,
right,
that were from time to time attempts to make reconciliation. But before we get to the two that you want to talk about, the Council
right.
of Lyon and the Council of Florence, at 1054,
right,
were there, after the schism, separate councils, Western councils, Eastern councils, that consciously met as a divided church?
I'm not as up on the Eastern Church because that's not as much my specialty, but in the West there were definitely councils that met throughout the 12th century, particularly in the 12th century from in the medieval West. That's really the rise of what most of us medieval scholars call the papal monarchy, and there were a number of church councils that made important decisions about things. So, yes, in the West, they definitely went right on functioning as if the Pope is the head of the church, and from their perspective, it became more entrenched, the notion of papal primacy, and that would always be a sticking point with any kind of reconciliation. It became more entrenched, not less entrenched, the idea of papal primacy.
In 1274, the Second Council of
right.
Lyon, could you honestly call this an ecumenical or a universal council for the church?
Well, I couldn't, but... I wouldn't, but I don't think many Easterners would consider it either, but it was a papal-led council from their perspective. It was. It was Pope Gregory X, and it does relate to that emperor I just mentioned, the guy who restored and Michael VIII. He was looking for help from the West by this time, both against the Turks to his east. The Turks had taken over much of what would be Turkey today. And they were on his doors, and he had all kinds of rebels of his own he was dealing with in Greece. There were Westerners who were attacking his possessions in Greece. The brother of the King of France, Charles of Anjou, was attacking his kingdoms and his territory in Greece. So he went to the West looking for help, and basically they told him, "Well, the Pope said in 1274, we'll stick up for you if you reunite." So a way to get Westerners from attacking him was to reunite with the Pope, to basically get the churches to reunite. So basically, he strong arms a patriarch and some church members, some leaders of the church, to go to the Second Council of Lyon in 1274, and they basically they do a worship service, they confess the Filioque, and they say they reunited. And they recognize papal authority, and he actually gets a pro-union patriarch appointed. They go back to Constantinople, and he says, "We've reunited." And everybody looks at him and goes, "No, you haven't. We don't agree with that." So it was like a lead balloon. It was one of those church programs, you know, where the guy shows up and says, "This is our big program," and everybody just kind of looks at him like, "Well, we're not doing that." So during Michael's reign, for the rest of his reign, he acted as if he was reunited. And he had some church leaders that promoted it. But for the most part, once he dies, his son goes, I mean, it's just not accepted. At this point, most of the clergy are not going to accept it, and most of the people don't accept it reuniting with. Because the sticking point is always, well, if you reunite with us, you have to recognize the authority of the papacy. And most people just weren't going to go along with that.
Historically speaking, is that going to be the problem from that point on?
I think so. I think in the medieval church, like I said, by the 13th century, the papal claims are pretty clear. They're written down in canon law. That's when canon law is really established, and when it becomes, really formal. And there's just no way around it. You either accept the authority of the Pope or you don't. And there are a number. I was doing some research on this today, and I've read about some of them, but I didn't realize how many there were until I looked it up. There are a number of uniate or Eastern Rite churches in communion with Rome that have, I guess you could say, come back to Rome for various reasons over the years. Probably the more well-known was one in Western Russia or the Ukraine area. So there are a number of those that retain an Eastern Rite, and they look like a Orthodox-style church, but they actually recognize the Pope as the head of the church. So there are some of those that have come about over the years, but for the most part, most Eastern Orthodox churches have not done that.
Are these uniate churches, are they thereby considered or consider themselves out of fellowship with the Eastern Church?
Yeah, Eastern it's churches? Kind of odd. I mean, there are a lot of different cases of them. I was noticing there's ones all the way from, there's some in the Lebanon, what would be Lebanon, Syria today. There's Eastern Rite Catholics there is what they're usually called, I think. So they recognized the Pope, but the Pope over the there's one in the late 1500s that the papacy made union with, that one in the Ukraine, which is there's still part of that around in Western Russia and the Ukraine and Poland. So, they recognize the authority of the Pope, but they can follow their own Eastern rites, and their clergy, in many cases, can be married. So, that remember, that's a, if people don't know, Eastern clergy traditionally could be married. The priest, not a bishop, but a diocesan priest, could be married, but up in the Roman Church, by a little bit after 1000, it was pretty strictly enforced celibacy was. So, that was a distinction, too.
So, with respect to unity, the councils of... or the decrees of the Second Council of Lyon fall apart almost immediately.
Yeah, they're never, like I said, it's like a lead balloon when the guy goes back. He tries to enforce it till his reign ends in the 1280s, but his son, Andronicus II, repudiates the union when he becomes, because it just wasn't feasible. And it did cause a bit of a split back in the Byzantine territories. It did help him politically, though. It made the Pope... Get Charles Anjou and other Western forces. It made the Pope write them and say, "Hey, you shouldn't be attacking this guy who just rejoined with the Roman Church. He's our brother now." So, it was as much a political move as anything, and it did help him a bit in his foreign policy, but did not help the Church in overall.
Do any of those, speaking kind of regionally, we're talking here now about the location of the former Byzantine Empire. We're talking about its fall on the other side of the break. Do any of those Union churches still exist in that region? About a minute before we take a break.
Boy, that's a good question. I'm not as up on the contemporary stuff. I do think there's some Greek Catholic, I think is what they're called. Yeah, there's a Ukrainian Greek Catholic. There are some in the eastern places, but I think most of them are in, there are also some in, like I said, the Middle East. I don't think there's as many in those places, but there are some in the, probably in the Greek area. And in the Mediterranean.
Dr. Matt Phillips is our guest associate professor of history at Concordia University in Nebraska. It's part three of our four-part series on the Great Schism of 1054. Today we're talking about medieval attempts to reconcile the split between the Eastern and Western Church, another official attempt to reconcile with the Council in the 1430s. We'll talk about that on the other side of the break. You can join us with questions or comments. We're coming to you live this Friday afternoon, October the 21st, 1-877-623-MYIE, 877-623-6943. Talk back at issuesetc.org or send us a tweet at issuesetc.
Hello, this is Pastor Kevin Golden of Village Lutheran Church in Ladue, Missouri. The saints at Village Lutheran are proud to be part of the Issues Etc. 300, sharing in their Christ-centered, cross-focused proclamation of the gospel. If you find yourself in St. Louis, join us on Sundays at 8:15 and 10:45 for the Divine Service, 9:30 for Bible study and Sunday school, as we receive Christ's gifts of forgiveness, life, and salvation. Or visit us on the web at www.villagelutheranchurch.org.
Here's an opportunity for you to get up to 75% off many of the resources you hear us promote on Issues Etc. It's Concordia Publishing House's warehouse sale from 8 in the morning until noon on Saturday, November 5th. Concordia Publishing House is located south of Interstate 44 at 3558 South Jefferson in St. Louis. The 2011 warehouse sale, Saturday morning, November the 5th at Concordia Publishing House, 3558 South Jefferson in St. Louis.
Old theology, new technology. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Steadfast Lutherans. People who believe the law condemns everyone and should be preached to the fullest. People who believe the gospel is for everyone and should be preached to its sweetest. Traditional Lutheran doctrine and practice deliver every Sunday this law and gospel, that Christ was crucified for us sinners. To all who received him, who believed in his name, the Gospel of John says, he gave the right to become children of God. To see how Steadfast Lutherans preserves this good news for everyone, visit steadfastlutherans.org.
If any former evangelicals are hearing me speak right now, I want to assure you, you don't have to be a homeless Christian. If you would go to issuesetc.org, look on their website, you'll find a list of churches. Find one close to you and attend that church. There, you can receive the true gospel. You don't have to be a homeless Christian, and they will not call you a backslider.
To find a church near you, go to issuesetc.org and click Find a Church.
The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for October fits the month beautifully. This is Reformation Month. And, of course, the mind of the church, even those outside the stream of the Reformation, turns to that history surrounding the 16th century Reformation, in particular to Martin Luther. A lot of people associate the Reformation with his life. It's not just about Luther, one man's ideas, one man's struggle against a church that was erring. It was the effort of many, of whole congregations, of princes and many other personalities. That is reflected accurately in a new graphic novel from Concordia Publishing House, which is the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for October. It's called Luther, Echoes of the Hammer. Now, when you hear graphic novel, you're talking about what we used to call a comic book, but this isn't Superman or Wonder Woman. This is Luther and the Reformers and some serious history from Concordia Publishing House. Luther, Echoes of the Hammer. Find out more about it at our website, issuesetc.org. You can browse before you buy there or call and order Luther Echoes of the Hammer from Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. It's a third part of our four-part series on the Great Schism of 1054. We're talking about medieval attempts to reconcile East and West. Dr. Matt Phillips of Concordia University, Nebraska is our guest. Matt, let's talk about the council, or kind of a longer council, that was another official attempt at reconciliation between East and West, the Council of Florence. What do we need to know?
Yeah, I don't want to get too much in the history, but as far as the complications of it, we'll just call it the Council of Florence. It was a little bit complicated because when you talk about schisms in the West, they had just come out of their own, what's known sometimes as the Great Papal Schism in the West, and that had just ended in the 1415, 1417 time. And part of the ending of that schism said the theory known as conciliarism, which was we're going to have councils meet regularly to continually bring about reform in the church. So this council was called originally it met in Basel, and then it moved to Ferrara, and then it was moved from Ferrara to Florence. It moved from Ferrara, which is in Italy, to Florence because of plague. So it ends up in Florence. So we'll go to Florence because that's what it has to do with our talk specifically. What does it have to do with this with the East-West schism? Well, another Byzantine empire, very desperate by this time, comes to the West looking for help against the Ottoman Turks, who are right on the edge of ending the Byzantine Empire. This was John the Eighth, and the Ottoman Turks by this time have taken pretty much everything surrounding the Byzantine Empire. They control what today would be Turkey. They're controlling much of the southern Balkans area, and they've got him surrounded. So he's in desperate need of help, and he comes and shows up at the Council of Florence. This is the beginning. This is Renaissance Florence, by the way. Cosimo de' Medici, the great Renaissance banker, is the guy who basically got the council to come there. Well, one reason why he got it to come there. And so he shows up, and they do something similar to what happened before. In order to get help from the West, they have to essentially promise that they'll reunite. And he brings a patriarch with him and others, and they basically go through the whole thing again and promise to reunite with the West. And after this council, it's actually promoted throughout Europe that the two communions, if you will, have come back together. And I mean, it was published all over Europe and said we brought them back together. And the Pope Eugenius IV was his name, and he was the presiding pope. And it's greatly happily announced throughout the Western world. So the Council of Florence brings it all back together, and that's what. But it didn't end that way. And he goes back to Constantinople, where they're being besieged, and the people say we'd rather be ruled by the Turks than be in union with the papacy. So there you go.
Well, they kind of got
They got their wish.
They got what their wish because by mid-1450s, the Byzantine Empire has...
Yeah, Constantinople is taken in 1453 by Mehmet II, I believe it was, and it becomes the capital of the Ottoman Empire, which continues to grow well into the 16, 1700s. And they're pretty much ruled by the Turks, and much of the areas which continued to be the Eastern Orthodox Church, or the Greek Church, we might say, in this case, is ruled by the Ottoman Turks until World War I. Well, Greece becomes independent before that, but much of the area where many of the Eastern churches are ruled by the Turks and other Muslims.
Does that account for the distance, not just culturally, but the political and continued theological distance between East and West, in that that had the effect of isolating Eastern Rite Christians?
Absolutely. Something maybe we could talk about later, if we do it, the next show, is about what kind of happens later. I mean, you have a lot. The heart of Orthodoxy kind of moves north at that point. You still have a patriarch. The Turks allow the patriarch to stand. There's always a Greek community. There's a sizable number of Greeks and other groups. There's Bulgarians, which have Orthodox Church. Romania is Orthodox for the most part, and they also fall under the Turks eventually. And in Syria, you still have Orthodox Christians in the Middle East. But the heart of Orthodoxy will eventually move north toward to Russia, really, which is kind of interesting. So
with the last few minutes before we wrap up this part of our series with you, Dr. Phillips, talk about the rise of the Russian Orthodox Church.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Russia was converted in around 1000. The various Russian tribes are what leads to what develops into the Kingdom of Russia. They're ruled... different kingdoms develop, and duchies really, and what becomes what we think of as the Kingdom of Russia, and then later the Russian Empire, really doesn't develop until the 16th and 17th century. But the Russian Orthodox Church is very established by the 1200s. Now they live in the 13th, 14th, and early 15th century. The Mongols control or oppress Russians for a long time, but the Orthodoxy, the union of the Russian identity with the Orthodox Church connected with the Patriarch of Constantinople becomes extremely strong during that period. And by the time of the rise of Russia as a kingdom of itself in the 17th century, 1600s, the 17th century and into the 18th century, Orthodoxy is firmly established at the heart of Russian culture and society. They call themselves the Third Rome then. I mean, they actually connect themselves in that way, too. And their rulers are czars, which comes from the word Caesar, like Kaiser in German. So they do have that connection, which is interesting.
With only a minute, could you speak very briefly, and maybe we could do more so next time, about attempts on the part of the 16th century reformers to at least communicate with Orthodox Church leaders? About a minute before we...
I was just thinking about that. I'll probably need to do a little bit more research before we talk about that. I do have there's a book in English... I'm sitting on my shelf. I haven't looked at it in a while. I look at that one before, too. But, yeah, it's like Constantinople and Wittenberg or something like that. I don't know the title off the top of my head, but it's easy to find. There was a series of letters, I know, between Lutheran reformers and the patriarchs of Constantinople. Theologically, though, I would say, and there are probably some people that study this more specifically, I would say theologically, you know, the Lutherans and the Eastern Orthodox were never going to get together. I would say their theology of what we would call justification and sanctification are probably closer to Rome than they would be the Lutheran concept of justification. Now, we agree about the papacy, I guess, in many ways, in that we don't see the papacy as... We don't agree with what the popes have claimed and what the office of the papacy claims for itself. So that would be in a source of agreement, but... there were contacts, I know, between them. There were letters written back and forth. I believe even Philip Melanchthon writes letters as a correspondence. I don't know about Luther. I don't know if he ever did. But so that's about all I know about it right now.
Dr. Matt Phillips is Associate Professor of History at Concordia University, Nebraska. Thank you very much. We look forward to our next conversation.
All right. Thank you. Have a good weekend.
Next time, we will be responding to your questions and your comments on the Great Schism of 1054. Now, 1 week from today, we are going to, at long last, announce the winner of the Essential Lutheran Library. This is a stack of books, including Concordia of the Lutheran Confessions, the Lutheran Study Bible, Lutheran Service Book, Luther's Small Catechism, Lutheran Book of Prayer, and more, totaling almost $500 retail value. We're giving it away to one of our listeners, but in order to qualify for the giveaway, you need to share the Issues Etc., Latest Issues Etc., Reformation Week video from our Facebook page to your Facebook page. Our Facebook page, Issues ETC, I'm sorry, Facebook.com at Issues ETC, Facebook.com/Issues ETC. And when you find the video there, watch it yourself and then share it on your Facebook page. When you have, send us an email letting us know that you've done that for us. Thank you very much for doing it. Contest@issuesetc.org, contest@issuesetc.org. Then 1 week from today, at the end of Issues Etc. Reformation Week, we're going to choose one of our listeners' names, and they're going to win the Essential Lutheran Library. Thanks very much for helping us promote Issues Etc. Week that starts Monday on Issues Etc. Monday on the program, we'll kick off that Issues Etc. Reformation Week. Pastor Paul McCain of Concordia Publishing House will be our guest. He's going to have to fill big shoes. Last year was a great year of Issues Etc. Reformation Week. We're going to be talking about confessional Lutheranism and Roman Catholicism with Pastor Paul McCain of Concordia Publishing House, kicking off Issues Etc. Reformation Week Monday on the program. I'm Todd Wilkin. I'm looking forward to that whole week. I hope you are as well. Please tune in if you can live, but definitely catch it on demand. Issues Etc. Reformation Week begins Monday. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.